is the strange sensation that a lot of Christian and Christian-oriented people in this world and throughout the world feel like at this time. Peter, I think, has written an epistle to Christians who at that time felt very much like that, that they kind of felt like they knew what everything was about. They obeyed the gospel, and suddenly they're under fire, and it was ramping up. You know, it came to everybody at different times. Persecution would be worse in one community, and then it would spread to another, and it would get better, and then it would get worse, and it ebbed and flowed. But persecution was just a terrifying reality of the first century church. In our culture, 2,000 years later, in American culture, we are not being persecuted by any biblical definition of the word. We do face more opposition than we're used to. We do face a changed climate and a changed culture. But by and large, we are relatively safe as Christian people coming together to worship. We don't fear danger or violence by and large. Stephen, was it you that shared on Facebook just a little bit ago the most recent attack on the Coptic Christians in Egypt, 26 or something like that. I can't remember the final count of those who died. The Coptic Christians are an interesting group. They have nothing to do with the whole Western branch and story of Christianity. You know, you show the chart where there's Christianity and then Roman Catholicism and then there's the Reformation and then there's all the denominations and all this. Coptic Christianity had nothing to do with that. It was in Egypt doing its thing, and it never got bothered by what anybody was doing. It just kind of kept on doing its thing. And they're a little odd by our standards, but they're not connected to any of the kind of historic Western Christian traditions, which in some things is great for them because we haven't always had great Western Christian traditions. Anyway, they're an interesting group, and they're in Egypt, and they're dying. They're dying at an outrageous pace. In fact, when Stevens shared that on Facebook, my first thought was, I've already read that one. And then I went and looked and realized it's just that I've read so many now that I assumed that was the one I'd already read about. But it's gotten to be a weekly event that Egyptian Coptic Christians are murdered by someone in Egypt, usually in large numbers at a time. Going to Sunday morning worship in Egypt is life-threatening, and they're getting used to it. In fact, if you listen to their leaders talk, they'll say things like, well, this is the way things used to be centuries and centuries ago. I guess we better get used to it. And so that's what persecution looks like. We don't have that. We are simply in a world of, again, displacement, of feeling more and more like a minority and less like a majority in a country where we used to think we had kind of a voice in the way things were, and it sounded more or less vaguely Christian. That is less and less so. So what I think 1 Peter does then is, for us, it goes through a way of thinking about that. It says, Christians, you are pilgrims here. And pilgrims aren't in control. And pilgrims do suffer. Pilgrims are rejected. Pilgrims are reviled. You're passing through to elsewhere, another kind of kingdom. And then towards the end of the book, we're going to look finally now in chapters, a little bit out of chapter 4 and a little bit out of chapter 5. It prepares us by saying, now it's time to take a deep breath and be ready. So imagine for a moment you get terrible, terrible news of something that's going to happen to you. So your first response is panic. And you want to know all that you can know about it. And usually, if it's something really bad, you just can't know everything. That's the worst part about it. You just know it's going to be bad, right? And it frightens you. And then, hopefully, there is a brief moment before it happens where you're able to take a deep breath and ready yourself for what's about to come. You're not fully prepared because you probably can't be, but you realize you're as prepared as you're going to get, and off we go, right? There's that deep breath moment. I think the end of 1 Peter is God instructing us to take that deep breath. Say, we have now discussed for 3.5 chapters where we are as a people and what's going on. Take a deep breath, and now let's get to it. I think that's the message of the end of the book. So the lesson I'm titling, Ready. Okay? We're no longer taken by surprise. We're no longer shocked. This isn't an ambush. We have seen this coming. We've had our panic. We've lamented and been sad that this is happening, and now we're taking our deep breath, and we're going to decide to be Christians, and we're going to decide what that means. So chapter 4, verses 12 through 13 is where we're going to start, because I think it has a helpful phrase for us. Someone volunteer to read 1 Peter chapter 4, 12 and 13. James, thank you.
Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you to test you, as though something strange were happening to you. But rejoice insofar as you share Christ's sufferings, that you may also rejoice and be glad when his glory is revealed.
Thank you. First phrase there, where I want to really hit hard for a moment. Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery trial. This is not an ambush. This is a complete cultural invasion. Right? This is not a surprise. Once in a while, someone will say to me, Ben, can you believe what is happening? And my answer now every time is the same. Yes. There is no longer anything that I'm going to allow to surprise me. Can you believe what happened in... Yes. Yes, actually, I can. Right? Dad... preacher for many, many years, and quite often people told him he was a prophet of doom, you know, that he would say, things are going in a bad direction, and they'd say, things are going to get bad. Well, Frank, you just worry too much, you know. And for me, I've been hearing this my whole life, you know. Dad told me, don't be a preacher. Churches are going to be a thing of the past, you know. And stuff like that is what Dad used to say to me. I didn't listen, obviously, because here I am. But, he has for a long time said, there are bad influences in the world that are going to shake the very foundation of Christianity as we know it. And I think a lot of us kind of saw that coming, right? I mean, it's not a complete surprise. Now, here's a place I disagree with Dad. Now that I've kind of come to agree with him in the main point, Dad thinks he can pinpoint it to 4 or 5 decades ago. I think it started 4 or 5 centuries ago, but that's okay. We just disagree on the timeline. The point is, it's been coming a while, right? We've been headed this direction. It's just a question of how long we've been working at it and how successful it's been and when and what parts of the country and so forth. But things have changed, and we have to stop being surprised. We have to be informed and aware, but not surprised. I had a conversation this last Thursday. It is a conversation I never thought I'd have to have in my life. I may have mentioned to you, I can't remember if I've told you this or not, but Thursday or so ago, at the recommendation of another person who I'd asked a question in my capacity as a board member for Frog Road Christian Camp, we occasionally have questions about camp policy and things like that, and there was a set of questions that I just didn't have an answer to. And so they said, there's a guy you need to talk to who's been directing youth programs and camps out in California for a lot of years, and you need to check with him because they've been through it already. And so that Thursday afternoon, I had about an hour-long conversation with a guy about what to do with same-sex attracted and transgendered camp applicants when that starts coming up. And I never in my life thought as a camp board member I'd ever have to have that question. And it's possible, I'm not trying to frighten you and tell you that we have a huge problem or something, but it's the kind of thing that is increasingly more realistic a scenario than it used to be. And I was having a conversation with the board and said, we don't have any policies for that because we didn't need any. And now it might be that we at least ought to have a conversation about what dorm does a person go in who is anatomically female but claims they are transitioning to male and vice versa. That's a question we never thought we'd have to ask in our life. And here I am having a conversation with somebody. What are the rules for that? This is a whole new world. But having the conversation was my first step in saying, I'm no longer going to be surprised. One day when I get that first application that writes in a gender, I have two options on the application, by the way. You can mark male, you can mark female. Someone's going to surprise me with one, right? It's going to happen someday. And so now I've had the conversation with somebody. I've got the beginnings of what a policy might look like. I don't know if I've got an answer yet, but I've got a start. And I'm going to stop being surprised when that day comes. I'm going to say, ready, and we dive in, and we see where we go with that. That's the reality of our school administrators are already there, right? Our school and I see all the school administrators nodding their head. They've already had to take a deep breath and say, okay, here we are. My brother does IT emission systems for Lipscomb University in Nashville, and he says, you know, it used to be that it was a gender table in your access file, and it had two options. You know, it was this or that. He says, it's gotten to be a very big list of options that people have given us that we have to record as data and figure out what to do with. And this is a Christian university. He says, it's a weird thing that the administrators just weren't ready for. You know, what do you do with that data when you get it? What's our policy now? It was a couple of years ago. There was a fairly sizable demonstration at Harding's campus from within the student body of people who are of diverse gender. Let's say that. How about that? Diverse gender and sexual persuasion who felt like they were not welcomed at Harding's campus. And there was a protest. And the administrator said, we weren't ready for this conversation. We didn't think we were going to have it. And here we are. I think what Peter is telling us is, take your deep breath, get informed, and be ready. Because it's no longer a question of if. It's a question of when. The first time we had a question about same-sex attraction at camp was a couple of years ago. And it wasn't something we were informed of an application. There was an incident that took place that led us to believe someone, one of the teenagers, might have been behaving in a way that would lead someone to believe that they were attracted to a person of the same gender. And I remember the first staff meeting we had afterwards, and we said, this is not a distant reality anymore. This isn't one of these days. It is this week in June, right now, 2 years ago. Take your deep breath, and let's figure out how to help spiritually guide these children in what we thought were basic identities, like male and female and who you're attracted to. So that, I'm kind of harping on that topic because it's just one illustration of a lot of different topics where we have arrived. Take our deep breath, and Peter says, stop being surprised. For the Coptic Christians, stop being surprised, they're going to kill you Sunday. And they've kind of gotten used to that now. When I see the interviews with them, they just say things like, we're just expecting them to kill us now. And that's such a staggering thing to me. I don't know how you wake up in the morning and think, they're probably going to kill me on the way to church today. But they say, we've just stopped being surprised. We don't have anything like that, but we have challenges, and we have to stop being surprised. That's how you address challenges, not being shocked. Shock is over. God gave us a little time to be shocked. It's past now, and now we're going to deal with the reality as we face it. We can no longer act like we didn't see this coming. It's time for Christians to make a deliberate choice toward joy. And I say, Ben, how can you possibly take a deep breath and say ready and have joy at the same time? But that's how the verse ends. Verse 13, but rejoice insofar as you share Christ's suffering, that you may also rejoice and be glad when the glory is revealed. Peter has an equation there. He says, if you aren't rejoicing now, you won't rejoice then. And so it's time to rejoice. These obstacles are an opportunity for you to share in the suffering of Christ. As we've read throughout this book, Christ was rejected, Christ was reviled, Christ was opposed. So now this is our opportunity to be disciples of Christ. Did we really think it was always going to be easy? Did we let ourselves believe that? I think we did. I think we believed that. And some days remind you that it's not the case. Peter says, stop being surprised. Instead, say, look at the wonderful opportunity we have today to imitate Jesus, my Lord. That's exactly, and the disciples took that literally. Remember the passage in Acts chapter 5 where they beat the disciples and they go back to the other Christians and they worship and it says, they rejoiced that they were counted worthy to suffer in the name of Christ. And they literally, they rejoiced that they were doing a good enough job of being Christians, someone finally decided to hit them for it. Nobody's hit us in a while. When we get it right, they will. Okay? Just a reality. So he says, rejoice when you hit that moment, when you realize this is an opportunity to do the hard work of Christianity. That's not an easy thing. I don't know if any of us are going to be ready for it when it happens, but Peter says, it's time. Take your deep breath and be ready. No more surprises. We must say, this is a great time to be a Christian. And it is. The Christians that are alive today, this has been word of not really prophecy, okay? Not a prophet, but this is my pronouncement on it. The Christians who are alive today have the opportunity to be the Christians who have changed the world in a way it hasn't changed in generations. The obstacles and opportunities we face today are unparalleled in recent history, and that's why they're so scary. And we have great opportunities. It is a great time to be a Christian. It's a great difficult time, but it's a great time to be a Christian. So to get instructions on how to do that, let's take a look in chapter 5. And we're going to start in verse 6 and make our way through verse 11, and then that'll be yours for tonight. Somebody want to read for us chapter 5, verse 6. Denny, thank you. Amen. Thank you. So, starting in verse 6, humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God. Whose hand is mighty? It is not mine, and it never was. It's possible, and I don't mean this to be a harsh rebuke, but this is just a reality that we need to look in the mirror and think about. It's possible that when Christianity was a little easier for us, we all became a little bit proud and a little bit independent about how good things were going and how it allowed us some complacence. We must be doing everything right. Things are going well, right? And you tend to think, what a great job we're doing. It's hard to reach that far on my back, but I'll try. You know, and we all patted ourselves in the back. Times of ease tempt us toward pride. What does persecution allow for? Peter says humility. It allows you to remember who actually has power. The temptation in persecution, think about the first century, the temptation was to think that the persecutors had the power. Because clearly it wasn't you. They were killing you. The persecutors must have the power. Peter says, no, they don't either. Humility reminds you that no human has the power. It is the mighty hand of God who holds history in his hand. And so you humble yourself, not beneath the mighty hand of Caesar, beneath the mighty hand of God. Christians today, this is not a battle between Christian culture and secular culture, or Christian culture and postmodern culture, or Christian culture and whatever culture. This is a battle between human rebellion and the Almighty God, and His is the mighty hand. Right? It's not us versus the other us, or us versus them. It's God versus evil. And our task is to remind ourselves to be humble and remember our part in that. As people who have committed sins ourselves, we're at least partially to blame for the problem. We have been in some way part of it. And if not for the grace of God and the blood of Jesus Christ, we'd be as guilty as everybody else. It is humility beneath the hand of God that allows us to endure and be faithful in these difficult times. Times of trial are a time of humility and of dependence on God. The person who doesn't need anything forgets how much he needs. That's one of the frequent doctrines of Jesus. When you read the gospel accounts, he usually talks about it in terms of wealth and poverty, but it's the same theme, that when you have everything you need, you forget that you really need things. You forget that God has made all that possible. Remember, there was a certain man whose field brought forth plentifully, and he said, his barns were full. He said, "Soul, let's build bigger barns. Soul, take thy fill, eat, drink, and be merry." And God says, "Thou fool. It's never your fields, and it was never your crop, and you didn't do anything to get it anyway. You were fortunate. You were blessed, would be a better way to say it. And you took advantage of that. Pride creeped in." So this is a time where God is forcing upon us something we wouldn't take our medicine, and so now we're getting it. We are learning humility the hard way, and that's not always pleasant. But humility, in the end, allows God to do what we cannot. As long as you try to do God's job for him, it does not get done. Because he won't allow you to have the glory of it. God is jealous of his glory, and rightly so. He will not allow you to have the glory. So remember the story of Gideon? Gideon took a fine army up to go fight the enemy. And God says, "That's too many. You'll think you did it." And so the army gets smaller and gets smaller and gets smaller. One of you Bible class teachers, help me. Is it 300 at the end? No. 300 under Gideon go down, right? He said, this is enough to save you. This is enough to know that God saved you. So God will have his glory. Humility allows God to have his glory because we've stopped trying to take it from him. And throughout the scriptures, God often emphasizes that it is the lowly who are exalted and the proud who are not. We read this morning in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 5, God resists the proud and gives grace to the humble. That was also in the book of James. It's throughout the book of Proverbs. It's throughout the teachings of Jesus. It's in the life of Jesus himself. Philippians chapter 2, Christ, who was equal with God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God, took upon himself the form of a servant, being made in the likeness of men. He died even the death of the cross, that God may highly exalt him. Philippians chapter 2. When does God exalt him? When he is low. Humility allows God to exalt. That's what he's looking for, and that gives him the great glory. So this time of humility, and remember the word, humility is the nice way of saying it. What's the not-so-nice way of saying humility? Humiliation, right? Christianity feels like it's being humiliated. Well, they're related, and that means humility, right? Jesus was humiliated at the cross, literally mocked, spat upon, humiliated. And he demonstrated a great amount of humility in the way he endured humiliation. Well, Christianity today is having a moment of, in some regards, humiliation. And it's an opportunity for us to learn humility and allow God to do something that we would never have done ourselves. Verse 7.
Before you go on.
Nope, already went. Just kidding. Go ahead.
Come back.
Yeah.
Right at the end of that, we tend to forget that that he will lift us up in due time.
The ESV has in the proper time. Yeah.
Doesn't ever say when that is.
Yeah, now.
After life is over.
Yeah, we would like for that all wrongs to be righted at the time that I lose my patience.
Yeah.
And that's just not the calendar, is it?
Yeah. Give me patience right now.
Yeah, give me patience right now. Someone, yes, back here.
That we need to stop being surprised.
Yep.
When do we stop being angry? If
verse 7. Yes. Sure.
Nor was
he joyful. No.
He ran the money changers out of the temple because the desecration that was going on because they were desecrating God's place of worship.
Yep.
And if I'm attacked personally, I guess I can deal with that and I'll try to be humble. But when they begin to attack my culture as a Christian, am I not allowed to stand up?
I think verse 7 has at least a partial answer, so let me just turn to that and see if we get close. That Peter recognizes that you are going to have whatever word you want to use, anger, frustration. He uses the word in the ESV, anxiety. Does the King James say care? Cast your care upon him? Care, yeah. Care is a nice way of saying I'm angry. I mean, I care about that, and I'm upset that this is what's happening. Or, again, the ESV has it as anxiety. Here are all the things that I want to be different than they are. And I'm not happy about it. Anxiety is an unhappy feeling, right? What do we do with that? Peter never suggests that it goes away. He never says you should be perfectly content that everything's wrong, right? He recognizes that for you to be a righteous person in an unrighteous world is going to create some anxiety, that it feels like everything's wrong, because it kind of is, right? What he says is that there's something to do with that, and that is to cast or direct that towards God. That we have to be careful not to lose control, right? So if Christians just walk around in a state of constant anger, have you ever had anyone argue with you who was already angry from the time they started? Okay? It's not very convincing, is it? Right. If from word one, they're already mad. I won't name names, but some of our members here are school teachers, and one of them was telling me a story of a parent who came in and wanted to have a word with her, and wanting to have a word with her actually meant, I want to yell at you. And this was not a conversation. This was a one-way, I'm angry about the way this worked out, and that's you're going to hear about it. Okay, that's not helpful, and it's the same way with Christianity, right? If we go to people who are very much in the wrong, and we're already angry and we're here to tell them about it, that's not very persuasive. It's not that we're wrong to be angry. It's not that we're wrong about why we're angry. It's just it's not necessarily helpful, right, to walk up and say, you're wrong and I'm angry about it, right? Not helpful. So Peter says, let's take the anger to God. God's big enough, he can handle it. And we've been reading the Psalms for 3 years now. And how many of the Psalms say something like that? God, I'm upset. It seems like the bad guys are winning. And I'm mad about it. God, when are you going to wake up and do something about it? God, act. Many of the Psalms are just almost indignant. God invites us to be unhappy about the way the world is and to direct that to him in prayer and to ask him to change it. Because when I keep it inside and use it on others, I'm angry and I'm going to fix it by being angry at you. Well, that's not the humility we're looking for. When instead I say, I'm angry, God is the only one who can fix it. That allows me now the freedom to go have the conversations that need to be had. Christians don't need to be silent. To go have the conversations that need to be had, but to have them without the anxiety and the care that is actually hindrances to the conversations we need to have. And that's what I think the early church did. If you look at the way they suffered, I know they had to be angry when the Romans hauled off their wives and children and killed them. They had to be angry. But they didn't direct it at the Romans. They prayed to God and said, how long? The book of Revelation records that. The heads at the altar, right, Randy? The heads at the altar say, Lord, faithful and true, how long? Till you do something about it. And that allowed them to act more like Jesus in their persecution. By the way, was Jesus angry when they decided to crucify him? Trick question. I think he was. I think he was irate. I think the indignancy of a human being crucifying the Lord of glory had to provoke him. He just didn't act in anger. Instead, he says, Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. My God, why have you forsaken me? He talks to God. He doesn't yell at Pilate. He speaks to God. And so, to answer your question, I don't have a great answer because I'm not good at it, right? When I'm angry, I want to be angry at you because it's your fault. Pointed at Valerie because it's always her fault. No, I want to find somebody and I want to show my displeasure because that will fix it. And God seems to remind us over and over again that doesn't actually seem to help. He never tells us to be quiet. And that, I think, is the false choice we sometimes think we have. I can speak up and be angry or I can do nothing. No. Christianity says there's actually another option. There's doing something, but not letting the anger get the better of us that actually prevents us from doing good things. And that is not easy, but it is the way of Christ. And I think Peter is inviting us to learn it here. Cast your anxiety on God, not the Romans. Romans can't do anything about it anyway. Cast your care upon God, and then get back to work. That is a delicate balance, and I think every generation, Jim, has to figure out what that looks like. I mean, how much do I speak and how loudly do I holler before I stop being effective and just start being that guy? We've all seen the guy on the street corner with the sign, right? The end is near, you're all going to burn. We had a guy, he was a campus preacher who came by to OU. He hit all the colleges. And he'd come down to the corner and he'd yell at us as we went to class in Norman and tell us we were all going to hell. And a lot of things he said were right, by the way. He said, all you frat boys just think about sex and alcohol. Well, he wasn't wrong about that. I mean, there was a lot of that going on. And he had a lot of comments about the evil in the world that weren't wrong. How many of us do you think stopped and listened? All right. So we have to figure out what is the effective way to do God's work. And then all of the anger. Now, he went home feeling better. He went home feeling like he had done something. He was angry and he did something about it. But he didn't actually do anything about it. Cast your care upon God, and then you get to work doing what he wills in this world, and that anger goes somewhere else. That's the best I've got, and that's not a helpful answer, but it's the best I've got. the verse ends in verse 7, because he cares for you. I think you find the Psalms the most angry when the psalmist says something like, it feels like you're asleep, God. When you feel like God isn't paying attention is when we get angry. It's not just that the world is wrong. We're also just a little bit mad at God because we want him to fix it right now. And so the Bible reminds us, he does care. He absolutely cares about every wrong in this world and every right to. And so we turn to him in prayer. Let me pause. There was a hand over here, and then you. Yeah, Larry.
I understand all that, and I don't have much problem. Where I have a big problem is a lot of the, quote, church leaders, they are actually changing their policy, bending down to go along with all. I mean, I understand it's going to be there, and you got it.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Exactly what God said not to do for sin.
I've had to pay attention a lot to some of our, our religious neighbors who have gone through some of these cultural battles. I've watched the Methodists go through it. They're still going through it. Presbyterians are on the other side of theirs, where the Presbyterian Church just said, yeah, we are going to accept same-sex marriage. That's our official policy. And then now suddenly there's two sets of Presbyterians, and some say yes and some say no. And if they own your building, do you buy it back? And it was a convoluted mess. The Anglicans went through the same thing. Yeah, we have a lot of people who were supposed to be leading religious folk who actually were doing it because it was convenient. And now that it's no longer convenient, they're not doing it anymore. And that is a tragedy that we certainly don't want to be guilty of ourselves. Okay, Jim, you had a further comment or... Yeah, I think we do have two false choices, that one of them is let's be angry and go holler at people, and one is let's do nothing and not care. And neither one of those are the Christian solution, right? There is a Christian alternative. Was Jesus ever silent when he needed to speak? He often said things calmly that I would have said very loudly, and sometimes he raised his voice, but often he knew how to handle those difficult situations. There is a way for Christians to speak and act that's neither complacent nor egotistical and self-centered. This is all about me and I'm angry and you're going to hear about it, right? There is a way. It's a challenge and we've got to work it out, but it is possible. A couple more thoughts here. Time's going to get away from me. I appreciate the comments. Verse 7. I'm sorry. I didn't update the screen. Verse 8. Be sober-minded. Be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. Trials are a time of sobriety. When hard times come, you don't want to be drunk. I mean, just to put it bluntly, this isn't about drunkenness. It's about a sober mind. But the point is, if you're in a stupor, you're not prepared. That's why we say don't drink and drive, right? Why do the police tell us not to drink and drive? Because you don't. Why do our pill bottles say don't operate heavy machinery? Because if you're doing something important, you don't want to be half awake or in a stupor. Christians, we are in a moment of significance. There are no insignificant moments, but this is an especially significant moment in the life of the church. So we do have to be sober-minded and awake. We're operating heavy machinery. Okay? Be aware of what we're doing. Trials are a time that require great wisdom, of readiness, of preparation. That's why we're calling this lesson, be ready. Take a deep breath. Be wise and consider what needs to be done. And trials are a time for a reality check. This gets back to Jim's point about being oblivious. Some people have kind of gone through life thinking there is no enemy and there's nothing wrong in the world and everything's okay and don't worry about it. And Peter first says, cast your care upon God, but then he says, be aware there is an adversary. It's not the person next to you, but it is the devil, and the devil's going to make use of whoever he can get a hold of. So be aware there is real evil in the world. Hayden has got so sick of me saying that that he can now anticipate me saying it before I say it and repeat it to me, so I guess I say it too much. But there is actual real evil in the world, and we have to be aware of that. That's what we're up against, and not the other stuff. Verse 9, resist him, firm in the faith. This is a great encouragement to me. Our command from God is not actually to win. Our command is to resist. The winning is actually up to God. Victory belongs to the Lord, says the Old Testament. Victory belongs to the Lord. When David went up against Goliath, was it his job to kill Goliath? His job was to stand up and throw a rock. To be perfect, that's the way David saw it. The God who delivered me from the lion and from the bear will deliver me from this Philistine. His job was to stand up and be counted. His job was to resist when everyone else was cowering in fear. Our job is to be faithful. Is that going to be easy? No. But our job is not to calculate how to arrive at ultimate victory. I think there are a lot of people kind of overthinking it. Well, here's what we need to do to get this back. The getting it back is not up to us. Being faithful is up to us. You resist the devil, firm in your faith, and be aware that you're not in it by yourself. That's Peter's response to the woe is me attitude. So I'm not picking on you, Jim, but since you brought it up, I'll just mention, when I get really angry, and I do sometimes, I try not to bring it into the pulpit with me because I think it's inappropriate, but I do get angry when I see things. I try to think about somebody like the Coptic Christians. There's somebody else in the world. You know, they're not killing me yet. And I try to remember what Peter says. Ben, do you think you're going through anything in the buckle of the Bible Belt in Oklahoma that even compares to what people elsewhere are going through? And I take a deep breath and say, okay, we can handle this. He has not given us more than we can handle. He hasn't even given us the same he's given other people. We can handle this. So be aware that your others in the world have gone through much the same. And verse 10, after you have suffered a little while, the God of all grace, he's going to do four things. He's going to restore. Remember, the victory's not up to you. You resist. What does God do? God's going to fix things. God's going to confirm things. All the doubts you had while you were suffering, am I doing the right thing? Was this the right choice? God's going to confirm those things. He is going to strengthen you and allow you to endure if you'll be faithful. You resist, God does the winning, and he will establish you. Christianity has faced worse things than modern American culture. We have faced more vile and disreputable enemies from within and without in the last 2,000 years. And none of them have gotten rid of us yet. And it's not because of us. It's because God is tremendously stubborn. He will have his glory, and this world will not overcome him. So said our Lord, the gates of hell will not prevail against it. And so God does the establishing. God makes sure it stands. And that's where verse 11 ends, which I think is extraordinarily important. I know I'm out of time. Let me just give you these 2 points. To him be the dominion forever and ever. Amen. This is what Christians have to remember when things are not going well. The ending was never in doubt. God will have his glory and his kingdom will stand. The ending was never in doubt. And the story was never about you. When we make it all about me, then I have to worry about how it's going to work out and whether I'm going to be satisfied. It's about God and his glory and him being recognized for who he is. It is about the lordship of his son. It's about him. And I am privileged to be a part of that. But it's not the gospel of Ben. It's the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. The ending is not in doubt, and the story was never about me to start with. When you keep that in perspective, whatever the church faces now or in the future, God will establish his people. Thanks for your comments. I appreciate it. I think these are difficult thoughts. I think we have to struggle with them. We're supposed to, but take a deep breath and be ready.